SimplySafe.com. Whole home protection, protection for every window, room, and door against intruders, fires, water damage, medical emergencies, and more. All monitored 24/7 by professionals ready to dispatch police. Everything you need to know. Expert Chief SimpliSafe Home Security, named Best Home Security Overall by U.S. News and World Report. Awarded by Popular Mechanics and more. Like live professional alerts. Our monitoring staff calls you when trouble is detected and stays with you until it's solved. Dispatch faster with usual verification. Adding visual verification to your monitoring plan lets us verify your alarm is ready so police can dispatch faster. It's a lot less expensive. We cut out the middleman and mark up so you get more security for less with no contact. Prepared for the unexpected. Lose power, lose Wi-Fi, someone attacks the system, natural disaster, SimpliSafe is ready. Protects against fires and water damage, more than just intruders. Our pros monitor against leaks, floods, fires, and more. Keep an eye inside and out. With HD security cameras for indoors and out, see what's happening all the time. Designated to disappear from the tiny size of our sensors to easy one-touch control means they'll never notice your security system. Detects people, ignores pests. Motion sensors use a precision human form detection algorithm. Compare your security options. Traditional home security monitored by professional 36-month contract. Monitoring costs $37 to $53 a month. Hardwired, never needs a landline. Poor rating on Trustpilot. SimpliSafe, the better way. Monitored by professionals, no contract. Wireless, no drilling or landline required. Great rating on Trustpilot. Easy to set up yourself in no time. How it works, choose your security sensors, we'll walk you through exactly what your home needs and ship it to your front door under a week. Set it up in just a few minutes, no trials needed, or let one of our pros do it for you. Sensors guard all your rooms and entry points. If there is a trouble, our monitoring center will call you and if needed, dispatch authorities. More reasons to choose SimpliSafe. Arm, disarm from your anywhere, forgot to arm your system, need to let someone in, do it right from your phone anytime. Almost never change your batteries. Batteries last all for almost a decade and entry sensors, the best lifespan in the industry. Battery life may vary based on use. Alexa, arm my system, use your system with Alexa, Google Assistant, August Locks, Apple Watch, and more. Keep an eye on cabinets, safes, and more. Secret alerts quietly alerts you if someone accesses private areas without sounding an alarm. Customized for your home. Well, we'll customize the right system for your home's needs. Incredible range. Many wireless security systems struggle to cover your entire house. Ours can cover large homes with ease. Custom alerts for friends and family. Set up text alerts so friends and family stay in the know. Duress pin. If someone forces you to disarm your system, your duress pin will securely alert the authorities. Meet the station. Boost station. The trust comes with a built-in cell connection to rapidly alert our emergency dispatch center. Try it, test it, love it, or return it. Test SimpliSafe in your home for 60 days. Your system is ready to work. No drilling or tools needed. If you aren't 100% set, we'll return it for a full refund. We'll even pay for return shipping. Here, hope you had a good Easter. Here is chapter 18 of American Dirt by Janine Cummins. Look at life these days where all the homes are lined up like soldiers with identical uniforms, indestructible white stucco walls, helmets of red Spanish tile, all tilted at the same to the angle to the sun. He likes the anonymity of them and thinks how nice it would be to live inside one of those houses with Mamie, how nobody would ever find them there. One thing he doesn't like is when the train tracks temporarily veer south, because even though he misses home, he misses only the life that existed in Acapulco before the quinceañera. And he understands that to be a place that no longer exists is nostalgia for a phantom limb, so he's relieved when the tracks bend toward the west again, and then there are a neat little town in Jalisco, settled up beside El Rio Grande de Santiago, and at long last curved northward. The city appears graduated with and with fall, several false starts where Luca enters all the familiar symptoms of the of an urban metropolitan food vendors who process the girls to wave up at the passing migrants, the occasional clothesline strung with bright colors snapping in the sunny wind, a gathering of rowdy kids along the fence of a schoolyard, and then boom, all it all recedes, and it's just cornfields, cornfields, cornfields. Two times this happens, three, four, and then finally, unmistakably, Guadalajara. Second largest city in Mexico, state capital of Jalisco, population 1.5 million people. All across the top of the train, migrants prepared to disembark. They whip their friends, stuff wadded up jacket pillows into their bags. They tighten the straps on one of their backpacks. Vivian strips herself from the train, but leaves Lucas belt attached to the grating. Lucas sits in the same spot, in the same position, and observes. Lucas doesn't like the way he watches Rebecca and Soledad. Maybe, Lucas says, as the train slows enough that some of the men and their car begin to climb down the ladder and jump to the gravel below. Lydia's rolling up her canvas belt, and she looks at Lucas with her wet face. I don't need the belt, he says. You need the belt, Mamie. Mamie, this time she does the more aggressive version of her wet face. If I'm still a jump on and off a moving train, don't you think it's a little sad to buckle me in like a toddler? Lucas jets out his chin at her. She grabs his chin in her hand, pulls her face down to his. The unchanged nature of her temper when he's ill-mannered is a comfort like a hot bath. It is not silly, she says. We ride these trains because we have no choice, but they are extremely dangerous, Luca. Did you learn nothing back there when that man fell? Okay, he says irritably. Fine. He tries to wiggle his chin away from her, but she only squeezes harder. He still has control of his own eyeballs, though she can't squeeze those. He moves his gaze away from her face to her left ear. Don't interrupt me, she says. And look at me when I'm speaking to you. He looks at that earlobe. Luca, look at me. He returns his gaze to her face momentarily and then moves it away again. Listen, I know this is all crazy. It's reckless and wild, riding these trains, sleeping in strange places, eating strange things, and I know I haven't said it before now. But Luca, I'm so proud of you. He looks at to her. He looks her briefly in the eye. I am, she says. It's incredible how strong you are, that you're able to do these inconceivable things. Luca has an unexpected thought. Can you imagine what Pepe would say? Lydia lets go of his chin and smiles at him. Pepe would say we are both crazy. Tears spring into Luca's eyes, but he doesn't want them there, so he makes them disappear. Lydia drops her voice to whisper, Pepe would be so proud of you. You're capable of things I had no idea you could do, Luca. She squeezes his knee. I never knew. She reaches across the landscape of a tangled legs to grab Luca's hand. But you're still my boy, do you understand? He nods. E por Dios. If anything happened to you, Luca, I couldn't bear it. I know how much you've grown in these last days, but your body's still only 8 years old. Almost 9, he says. Almost 9, she agrees. But please, please listen. Never be complacent. Never assume you're safe on this train. No one is safe. Do you understand? No one, she agrees with him. Machismo will get you killed. Luca learns again. The train is slowed to a placid roll beneath them, and Soledad and Rebecca both tie up their hair to disembark. They're wearing their backpacks and their turn talking with a group of four men who've been in front of them since Celaya. One of the men made this journey before. He's been deported twice from San Diego, so this is his third pass through Guadalajara. He's warning them. He runs the eardrops. You have to get off before El Verde, the man tells the sisters. You have to walk the next part of the tracks. Why, Soledad reaches up to tighten her black hair in its fixed coil. The people of the city are kind to migrants. God bless them. You will find a good welcome here. But first, you have to get past La Policia. They clear the trains at El Verde, and if they catch you, the man finishes only with a shake of his head. Don't let them catch you. Soledad fills in the blank for him. That's right, he says. And stay with the group. You can come with us if you want. His friends, one by one, begin moving toward the ladder, and he follows. Rebecca relays all the information quickly to Lydia, as just going with him. Lydia hesitates. She knows how dangerous it is to trust anyone on La Bestia. There are thugs and rapists and thieves and narcos hidden in the ranks of La Bestia in every town, but it's not only the police who deserve their suspicion. It's every single person they meet, shopkeepers, food vendors, humanitarians, children, priests, even their fellow migrants, especially their fellow migrants. She glances at Lorenzo's clean, expensive sneakers. It's a common tactic for bad actors to ride the trains, posing as migrants working to gain the trust of unsuspecting travelers so they can lure them into a secluded place where they can commit some violence against them. Lydia understands the increased probability of that plan is being leveled against the citizens. Any gesture of kindness, any value, little nugget of shared information, any pitiful story of heartbreak may be only a well-designed trap, a prequel to robbery or rape or kidnapping. Lydia's brain makes her do the work of considering all this before she decides, but there's no time. The train rolls on and the men are getting off. In fact, the whole train seems to be empty. These four men seem kind. They have the steep accents of Central Americans. They're probably Central Americans, right? Lydia has to decide. Lorenzo's waiting for them her to decide, too. Why is he waiting? His lingering presence makes the decision. She unbuckles Luca and stuffs his belt to her pack. Let's go, Lorenzo follows. For the first while, it's all warehouses to one side of the tracks and all dirt and grass and open sky on the other. So Luca has the impression of walking just outside of something like the warehouse is a kind of a border, fencing something better beyond. They stick to the tracks where dozens of migrants walk ahead of and behind them in a sort of miniature caravan. The boy Lorenzo hangs close, walking with them exactly, but falling only a few feet behind, matching his pace. There's Lucas worried about that boy, but he's distracted by the unmistakable smell of chocolate, which adds to the sense that nearby there's something much better. Do you smell that, Luca asks Rebecca? Chocolate? She nods. Oh, nope, don't smell, she says. Luca laughs. Well, I sure do. They trudge ahead, passing behind the Hershey's factory without ever realizing it's there. Luca presses a fist against his stomach to discourage the groaning. They haven't eaten since breakfast at the Casa in Soleil, and now it's late afternoon. Hungry, maybe, he asks. He nods. Me too. When the warehouses give way to brick and cinder block homes, the migrants are cheered by the appearance of two pigtail girls in school uniforms, one slightly larger than the other, one with dimples and one with a scab on her knee. The mother sits in a wooden stall nearby with a cool drink and a small grill. She's selling lemonade and hot ears of grilled corn. A fat baby sleeps in a stroller by her side. There's a large basket there to which the girls return in swoops, retrieving armloads of little white paper bags. These they pass out to the migrants with their blessings. Buenvenidos al Guadalajara, the girls say, and may God bless you on your journey. The one with the scabby knee presses a bag into Luca's hand and one into Rebecca's. Thank you, Luca says. The girl skips away, the hem of her blue plastic skirt brushing against her brown legs. As she goes, Luca whips into the bag. Mamie, it's chocolate. There are three Hershey's Kisses inside. As the city grows dense around them, people come and go across the tracks carrying lunchboxes or bags of groceries. Kids with brightly colored backpacks hold their mother's hands and climb across the rails. Men and Luca and Mamie right in the eye and say, God bless you, and they smile. Luca would like to smile back, but he feels peculiar too. He is unaccustomed to pity. At El Verde, there's a pink bench outside a neat walled-in garden. The bench is painted orange, pink, and yellow, and the sign on the wall behind it reads, Migrantes pueden descansar aquí. Migrants can rest here. A large mustached man is sitting on the bench, and when he sees the migrants approaching, he stands, fixes a cowboy hat over his bald head, and retrieves a bat-sized machete from the ground beneath him. He walks toward the trucks with the machete still in his teeth, and keeps his tip back over one shoulder. Amigos, hoy es su día de suerte, he says loudly, so they can all hear. Today's your lucky day. I will walk with you. The migrants in front of Luca and Mamie cheer, but Rebecca and Soledad exchange before he closes. The man falls a step beside them. You are right to be afraid, he says, not of me. Rebecca sticks her thumbs under the straps of Rebecca and says nothing. You have come a long way, yes, Honduras, Guatemala. Honduras, Rebecca is first to relent. Your journey has been okay so far, he asks. Rebecca shrugs. They walk in for a few moments in silence, only the sound of their jeans swishing beneath them as they go. Luca holds Mamie's hand, but he strains against it, pulling her arm taut, nearly taut, as he tries to hear what the man is saying to the sisters. Well, I want you to have happy memories of Guadalajara. He smiles and catches Luca, but look at them. Looking at them, he's so large he could use that machete as a toothpick. Luca shines back to Mamie's side. My name is Danilo, and when you get to wherever you're going, when you find a job in a good house, and you meet a beautiful gringo boy, and you get married and have your children one day when you're an old lady and you're tucking your niñitos into bed, I want you to tell them that long ago you met a nice man in Guadalajara named Danilo, and that he walked with you, and that he swung his machete around to make sure the knuckles didn't get any ideas. Rebecca relaxes now. She can't help herself. See, I'm not so bad. Sola is still apprehensive. Where are all these knuckleheads hiding out? Oh, Amigita, Janilla frowns. I'm afraid you will meet many of them in short order. Sola raises her eyebrows but doesn't respond. It's like the good, the bad, and the ugly in this city, Janilla says, and the beautiful Lorenzo hands gesture towards the sisters. Luda cringes. Why is he still here? Walking just behind them and listening in on every word. She shows out his mark, noting how the girls draw their bodies closely in instinctive response. Danilo continues as if Danilo hasn't spoken at all. It's a long walk from here into the migrant places, he says, and there are many dangers. What kind of dangers, Lydia asks? The usual kind, Danilo says. La Policia, railroad employees, security guards, especially dangerous for you two. He looks at the sisters briefly. It's better to get off the tracks before you get to Las Juntas. Go into the streets and make your way to one of the shelters. There are signs for them, or shopkeepers report the way. If anyone says they will take you there, don't go with them. If anyone offers you a job or a place to stay, don't go with them. If anyone talks to you first, don't speak with them. If you need directions, ask only the shopkeepers. I will go with you as far as La Piedra, a few miles. Why, so they ask. Why what? Why walk with us? Why not, Dino says. I do this 3 times a week, a walk with the migrants. It's my hobby, good exercise. But if it's as dangerous as you say, why do you do it? What's in it for you? Danilo has the kind of eyes that protrude slightly from beneath his lids, so there's no possibility of hiding their expression when he's in conversation. Luca can see that he's not annoyed by Solda's inquiry. He appreciates her skepticism. I will tell you the truth, he says. Then he pauses for a moment to smooth down his mustache with his thumb and index finger. When I was a teenager, I stole a truck. My father died in a work accident, and I was angry with his employer, so I stole that man's truck. I destroyed all the windows and the headlights using my father's hammer, and then I flashed his tires and I drove it into a sewer ditch. Seems reasonable to me, Rebecca says. I drank for 3 months. I did terrible things to him in my grief, but I never got caught, and God provided me with a good life anyway, despite my sins. So this is my penance. I am like the guardian devil who passed through my little neighborhood. I protect them. Solda looks up at him, narrowing one eye as she searches his expression for indications of deceit. She finds none. Okay, Danilo laughs. Okay. Yes, okay, Solda says. They are quiet again for a few moments. You ever have any trouble, Lorenzo asks from behind them? Ever get beat up or anything? Danilo turns without removing the machete from his shoulder and looks back at him. Not anymore, he says. Lorenzo nods and jams his hands into his pocket. Cool, cool. Luca begins chatting with Dilla and the girls, and the sisters, so Lydia drops back to walk beside Lorenzo. She's most repelled by and drawn to the information he might be able to provide. Maybe he knows which cartels have alliances with Los Jardineros, which routes present the greatest dangers of fear being recognized. She doesn't know how to begin the conversation because in her mind every question sounds like an accusation. Finally, she speaks out loud. How is it that you came to be traveling alone? Don't you have family in Guero? No, not really, Lorenzo has plucked up a blade of dry grass from beside the tracks and tucked it in the corner of his mouth. He speaks past it. But my mom got married a few years ago, and her husband didn't really want me around, so I split. Lily glances over at him. How old are you? 17. Younger than she thought. How old when you left home? Lorenzo looks up from his feet and snags the grass blade from his mouth. Push, I don't know, 13, 14, old enough to look after myself. Lily takes care not to contradict him, but he feels it anyway. Not everybody has a mammy like you, right? All right, some of us don't give a shit. He tosses the grass at his feet. I'm sorry, Lydia says, whatever, no importa. He slings his hands into the pockets of his baggy shorts. I was driving with my homeboy anyway. We left together because he wanted to get out too, but then we got separated in Mexico City and I haven't heard of him since. But you have a cell phone, he says. Yeah, it stopped working. Oh, they walk quietly for a few minutes, and then he says, yo, it was really sad what happened to El Jefe's daughter, but for real, what he did to your family. Eso fue de locos. Little friends, what? La chusa. What he did to your family, it was too much. When I saw that girl on news and her quince in their address. That girl, my niece, yeah, my goddaughter, Jennifer. Yeah, when I saw her on the news, I mean, for real, I was already thinking about leaving, but that was it for me. Shit is out of control down there. Lydia cannot discuss this with him. They are only biased to him. Strangers on the news, people like the ones he has killed himself. That girl with a Quincy on their address. But then Lydia's mind snags on the previous detail and exits rap. What happened to his daughter, he asked. She asked. Miranda looks confused, asked. So Lydia clarifies, Javier's daughter, Lella Chusa's daughter, you said it was said what happened to her. Yeah, you didn't hear. Hear what? What happened? On the day Sebastian's article was published, Javier read it in the back seat of his car while his driver shuffled through the soggy morning streets of Acapulco. All his life, Javier has enjoyed an almost preternatural ability to predict incidents and their outcomes. When he was 11 years old and his father was diagnosed with colon cancer, Javier knew that death would be swift. He knew that his mother, who previously had been a good mother, the one with an affection, would handle it poorly, that she'd medicate her grief with alcohol and new men. He foretold and accepted her abandonment well before it came to pass. As a result of that aptitude, Javier was almost immediately composed. Nothing ever really surprised him, so it was uncharacteristic that he failed to see the article coming. He wondered if his love for Lydia had blinded him to the inevitability of it, and that possibility caused him to feel a faint wriggle of resentment toward her. Even before he read it, and even with the anonymous byline, Javier, who read the article with his usual equanimity, presumed the article was the work of Lydia's husband, whose journalistic expertise in the drug trade was well known. Initially, he didn't need to measure his response because the article didn't provoke much feeling in him. On the contrary, Javier regarded it to be a mostly fair depiction of his life. There were, of course, some magical inaccuracies, one or two instances of exaggeration. There was more righteous condemnation that Javier was prepared to accept, but that was to be expected. Beyond those details, Javier thought Sebastian had managed to apprehend something true about the essence of Los Jardineros in Acapulco, and he was bewildered but unexpectedly pleased by the inclusion of his poem. Javier presumed that Lydia had somehow given it to her husband. Had she memorized it, a flattering notion, secretly photographed it with her cell phone during a moment of lapsed judgment? Though the poem revealed something intimate about him, it also illuminated his humanity, he thought. He therefore pretended that it might make him beloved by the people. He neither smiled nor scowled as he folded the newspaper and set it in the sunbeam on the letter seat beside him. Instead, he tried to anticipate the impact that it might have on his future. He understood immediately that there would be ramifications, that his jealousy and enmity was a thing of the past, that his liberty had been permanently compromised. He'd always known this would happen one day. He hadn't expected it to be so soon, but he would adapt. It was at worst a nuance, a nuisance. Perhaps it could even be fun. He couldn't recall another time the press had devoted so much attention to a cartel as young as Los Jardineros. It had taken years of establishment before ordinary people began to recognize names: El Chapo Guzman or Pablo Escobar. And there were plenty of people who still loved those men for their generosity and mythos, even after their spectacular downfalls. The only thing that truly unsettled Javier was his speculation that Lydia, his dear Lydia, had betrayed his confidence with the poem. That betrayal he had not foreseen, and it caused a treacherous quickening in his chest. But then it occurred to him that perhaps she hadn't been disloyal at all. Maybe she'd provided the poem as a faithful contribution, but not to his true self. Maybe the poem was a gift. Lydia knew Javier as well as anyone knew him. His first response to the article was exactly as she'd predicted. At that same moment, several miles away, just out at the outskirts of the city, on the sprawling finca with glittering all-day views of the turquoise sea, Javier's wife was also reading the article. She was a woman who had never been beautiful, but who took care to appear as if she might once have been. Her hair was a platinum, her mascara was and lipstick tastefully applied, her bosom maintained by the architect of expensive lingerie, her nails gleaming in a square and only a shade pinker than natural. She hadn't had a cigarette in almost 3 years, yet here she was, smoking, smoke curling from her tip of her quivering menthol. She had a name, but she seldom heard it. Instead, she heard Mama or Mi Reina or Doña. She'd reached her age when she expected each day to be the unveiling of some quiet new sorrow, and where she solemnly believed there was nothing in life that could truly surprise her. As she pursed her lips to draw on the menthol, the fine lines around her mouth became grooved. She stained the filter of her filter with a shimmer of gold coral lipstick and blew the smoke out over her one shoulder. A nervous page soundlessly approached and tipped extra coffee into her waiting cup. There were gold out wheeling over the dappled blue horizon. The bougainvillea sang, but she sat wordlessly rereading Sebastian's article for the third time. It troubled her, its unsettlings to see, emboldened by the veracity of black and white, the most deeply suppressed grumblings of your own leather conscience, printed right there in the newspaper for all the world to read. Javier's wife had failed to sufficiently calm herself when their daughter, Marta, called from boarding school in Barcelona later that afternoon and destroyed it with the simplicity of a single question. Mama, is it true? And because of her failure in that moment to adequately reassure her daughter, she would forever blame herself for what happened next. 3 days later, on the day before the universe quinceañera, the boarding school dean called to relay the news that Marta had been found hanging from the air conditioning in her dorm room by a pair of her roommates, knotted tights. The sonnet was addressed only to her father. One more death should not matter much. Thank you for listening to this chapter. Have a good week and stay safe.